It started to snow on Sunday afternoon, the 11th of March in 1888. Before the storm ended 4 days later, it had become the most terrible blizzard in the recorded history of New England and New York, the blizzard of 88. I'm Frank Atwood of WTIC. These recordings were made and first broadcast on the anniversary of the blizzard in 1961. We'll hear a scientific description of the storm by a meteorologist, Milt Barlow of the Travelers Weather Service. Then two first-person stories by elderly gentlemen who were young boys when the great blizzard snowed them in. We begin by noting that weather forecasters probably do not dare relax until after March 14th in any year, and Milt Barlow answers.
Yes, Frank, that's just about it. Normally one is led to believe that as March wears on, so does the winter, and the chances of a big storm are about over. However, this severe blizzard occurred in March, and our chances are still about the same, 1 or 2 in 100, that a similar storm may again occur during the 20th century. In fact, upper air conditions at times become most favorable for this type of storm during the month of March.
And I understand that 19 inches of snow fell in Hartford. Did other places throughout southern New England report greater amounts of snow than that recorded in the Hartford area?
Yes, Frank, the snow was deeper in most other areas in this vicinity, with 50 inches of snow in Middletown, 47 inches in Albany, 37 in Springfield, 42 in Thomaston, 45 down in the New Haven area, 21 in New York City, and a huge 58 inches at Saratoga, New York.
Tell us more about the storm, Milt, from the records. Where did it originate?
On Saturday morning, a storm that had moved in from off the Pacific was moving northeastward across Michigan. A secondary storm formed in the Carolinas and moved up to a position near Block Island, Rhode Island, on Monday morning. That was March 12th, and unloaded a huge amount of snow over all of the northeastern states. The storm became blocked in its normal northeasterly movement and actually moved northwestward for a while, loop to loop, and finally passed out to sea south of Nantucket on Wednesday, March 14th. Winds reached 50 miles per hour in the New York City area, 60 miles per hour in New Haven, and 70 in the Block Island area. To give one some idea of the wind's results, snowdrifts were 38 foot deep in New Haven County and up to 50 foot deep in Dutchess County over in New York State.
How did the temperatures run throughout the storm?
Well, it started off on a mild 40 degree pitch on Sunday, but by Tuesday morning it was 6 degrees above zero in Middletown, 7 above in New Haven, and well below zero over much of New York State. Temperatures were in the 30s over extreme eastern New England near Boston. The storm actually started off as rain in many areas, then a heavy wet snow, which gradually dried out and swirled around as temperatures and winds both increased.
We've been talking with meteorologist Milt Barlow of the Travelers Weather Service. Now a first-hand report from a retired Episcopal clergyman who lives now in Plainfield, Massachusetts, but was a small boy living with his family on a Connecticut farm in 1888. We visit the Reverend Sylvester Robertson at his home in the Berkshire Hills, and he recalls his personal experience in the great storm.
My father and mother, Mr. and Mrs. George M. Robertson, and my brother and I were living on our 100-acre farm in the Cutler's Farm District of Monroe, Connecticut. We were milking 20 cows at the time and were shipping the milk on weekdays in 40-quart cans to New York City by train. The fact stands out that I have kept the exact date of the beginning of the storm in my memory for two reasons. First, it was my mother's birthday, March the 11th, 1888. Secondly, my folks were entertaining the supply minister from New York City. They preached that morning at the Congregational Church at Monroe Center. Of course, entertaining the preacher, who came up to Stepney on the train Saturday afternoon and would stay until the train left for Bridgeport and New York on Monday morning, was a real event for my brother, then 7, and myself, almost 8. The Sunday dinner was chicken and all the fixings. To us boys, the occasion was just like Thanksgiving. About 3 o'clock Sunday afternoon, my brother and I were playing in our dooryard, working off that Sunday dinner, I suppose. There was no snow on the ground. What a change there was to be by Wednesday noon. The snow began to fall about 3 o'clock. Not large, wet, fluffy flakes, but tiny little dry, round flakes. By dark, it was really snowing and beginning to blow. By Monday morning, the storm had greatly increased, and there were drifts already in many places. No one should have ventured to travel, but the minister was determined to return at once to New York, although, had he known it, the Housatonic Railroad had already stopped its trains. Father and the preacher got into the cutter with buffalo robes and blankets and started. Going south down the road was not bad, was not so bad. The snow was more or less level, but at the Cutler's Farm schoolhouse, where you turn to the right and into an east and west road, there was trouble. They had not gone 100 feet when the horse encountered a drift up to his belly. Old Dick evidently thought he must go on, gave a lunge forward, and tore the shafts right off the sleigh. No repairs could be made in that howling wind and driving snow, so that they might return home. So my father helped the Reverend to the house of Frank Wales, who lived on the corner. Frank was a good man, but seldom attended church, and for several years the neighbors used to joke him about the time he entertained the preacher for 4 days. Father got old Dick out of the drift, turned him about, led him to the side of the sleigh, threw the robe over him, and by standing up on the edge of the cutter, got onto Dick's back. Starting Dick off towards home, bending his face to the horse's mane and covering his face with his arm, he gave the old horse the reins, and old Dick brought him safely to the horse barn door. Monday night, the wind was awful. My brother and I slept upstairs in the northwest bedroom. Not long after we had gone to bed, the lower sash of the north window blew out. We felt as if we would be blown out of the room. Father and mother came to the rescue and took mattress and bed clothing right down into the kitchen and made up a bed for us right by the stove. What a thrill it was for us to sleep on the floor by the stove. Our barn was diagonally across the road, and Tuesday morning Father began using a clothesline for a guide. One end he tied to a staple beside the kitchen door, and then, as he went to the barn, paid out the rope, so if he lost his bearings, he could find his way back to the house, having fastened the other end of the rope to the door of the barn. Wednesday forenoon, the storm had let up, and what a sight. A pear tree in our garden, 15 feet high, was the center of a drift which completely covered the tree. The roads were, of course, impassable until broken out. There were no telephones, no snowplows, no road rollers in those days, just oxen to wallow through the drifts, with two plows tied to the ends of the runners of an ox sled, so that the moldboards would make a path for oxen and sleds to follow. But somehow the neighbors got together with 3 yoke of oxen, loaded a sled with all of the 40-quart cans of milk they could get on, and started for the depot, hoping that the milk train would come through. They took an east and west lane between our farms and the adjoining one, and then kept to an old cart path through the woods where the snow had not drifted, emerging at a point on the road within sight of the station. Of course, all the boys in the neighborhood went along, for there was no school. When we reached Stepney Depot and Curtis's General Store, our father bought, to appease our appetites, the first sweet store crackers we had ever tasted. It was several days before the roads were open to our district school, much to our delight, for the sliding on the very hard crust over the walls and fences was wonderful.
For another story, we go to Amherst, Massachusetts, to call on Charles Adams Peters, retired professor of chemistry at the University of Massachusetts. His recollection of the blizzard takes us to eastern Massachusetts in an area which is now part of suburban Boston, but was then countryside.
In the great blizzard of 1888, I was a small boy, 13 years old. I'd outgrown the district school, the brick schoolhouse, which had only 8 grades. And it was necessary to go to the city to get the 9th grade. So every day went in on the train. It came about 9 o'clock. This Monday in March was worse, a good deal worse than the Sunday. But I had to go to school. So I made the mile to the station waiting for the 9 o'clock train. We waited and waited. The girls who went to the normal school turned around and went home. They were cold. I was nearly frozen. By 10 o'clock the train hadn't come, so I started home. This way back was against the wind, and you could go a little way and then you had to turn around, put your hands over your nose and your cheeks to keep them from freezing, and by we worked home. and I think it was then that I got some snow and held onto my nose to be sure it thawed out properly. That is what you're supposed to do if your face got frosted. Well, this continued for 3 days. The thermometer was 10 to 12 below all the time. We had a double window on our kitchen window. The thermometer was outside the double window. The problem inside of the house is get the frost scraped off of that window so we could see the thermometer. So they wouldn't be happy unless we knew how cold it was. Well, the barn was about 50 feet from the house and right angles to it. The barn is completely covered with snow. It came down from the eaves, way to the ground, solid. And of course, there was no chance of opening the barn door, which we really seldom did in the winter. We got in through a side door into the shop, and we had to tunnel before we could get into that door. But we had to get in there and get some water out of the house, water the kettle. But, well, you know about a pump in the cold weather, how you lift up the handle at night and let the air out and let the water all down the well. In the morning you take a kettle of hot water and pour in the pump and hope it catches. If it does, you get some water. If you don't, you try again. Well, we got water for the cattle, and then there were the hens to look after, because you had to dig out the hen house, but the hen house door opened inside, and that was a great help. We had to go out at least 3 times a day to get the eggs before they cracked, they'd be frozen. Well, it continued for 3 days. We didn't mind. At the end of 3 days, we couldn't get out. Nobody would plow out the road. As to getting anywhere, there's no particular importance, just to get the mail. And, of course, we'd like something from the public library. But we had frozen a quarter of beef in the back pantry, and we had potatoes and several vegetables in the cellar. And so we didn't care much how long we stayed. There were some eggs from the hen house and milk from the cow. Finally, we got out. But the snow lasted some time. I think it was in June that year, I went up back on the hill to the end of the farm. There's an east and west line, a stone wall. On the north side of that stone wall is a bank of snow.
The following first-person recollection stories were recorded for broadcast on WTIC Radio Hartford in 1967. J.B. Lewis, for many years a farmer in Southington, and at one time a representative from his town in the General Assembly, recorded this report at the age of 87.
Well, I went to school in the early morning, and at that time I presume I was building fires at the school, father being the district man at the and hiring the teacher and so forth. I had an early job of building fires and getting the school warmed up, ready for their school. About 9 o'clock, we opened up, and the storm was not so bad. It having begun and on late Sunday, and it was just an ordinary snowstorm. By soon after 9 o'clock, though, after school opened, it became a blizzard, very hard blowing, and one of our neighbors to the south, Mr. Ramsey, whose children were in school, started to come up to see how things were going. He found himself lost, having gone over the top of the stone wall down into our swamp, and taking his bearings there, managed to follow to the school. Later on, another neighbor down below, by the name of Edward Rouse, came with his horse, and they decided that we must get the children home. Mr. Rouse put the couple of the girls on the old mare's back, and then by taking hold of the mare's tail and stringing out Indian file, we were able to leave the school and reach our house, which was the second house from the school. There, Mr. Judd, who was the teacher, stayed with us and perhaps a couple of the children, the girls, and the rest went on to their home down through the neighborhood. The storm continued on for 3 days, so that by the end of that time, our house was buried from the ridge board clear out to the south. The veranda was filled within a foot of the top, and all of our doors to the house and windows, and the well too, which was on the house side, were buried under several feet of snow. The only place we could get in and out of the house was a stairway at the west end, which we used to take care of our stock at the barn. We had plenty of provisions, because at that time we always bought our flour by the barrel, sugar with 100 pound, and downstairs in the cellar with the hams, shoulders, and so forth from the fall butchering. For water, our well being covered in, the mother opened the south door, putting the wash boiler on the stove, filling it with snow, melted snow for our water supply. We didn't suffer at all in any way. In fact, it was quite a vacation having the neighbors and the teacher there with us during the extent of the storm. Our north and south road was not too badly drifted as a whole. The east and west roads were very badly drifted. In order to get out to the road, which was a custom with my father, to always go to the town every day and keep a road open in our storms, he put me on Old Town's back. The Old Town got in too deep and reared up and came over backwards by my pulling and landed on top of me in the soft snow. Father thought I must be seriously injured, so he rolled him off, and I went to the house crying. Nothing serious was harmed, just a bruise on the leg. Later on, got our team out and started down through the town. This time, our drifts were some of them 20 feet deep. In order to get through on the east and west road, we had to go into the lots on the shallower places in the snow. Then we came to the north side of the road and on down through to Oak Hill Cemetery, which was not as badly drifted, being woods on both sides. Then into town, which we found was completely drifted. Some of the stores were entered by tunnels in the snow on Center Street. Of course, my talk regarding the snow was for a district out in the country. The town was a good ways away at that time to us. It was 3 miles. At that time, each district was really a little center of itself. Our school had its own Christian Endeavor Society, and other social events were held at our own schoolhouse. One interesting feature of the storm, to show the severity of the storm, Dwight Bennett on Wolf Hill started to visit his neighbor 100 feet away, and when he reached the neighbor's house, found that his neighbor had started to visit him, and they had passed somewhere on the way. He immediately turned around and went home again, and when he reached home, found that the neighbor had done the same thing and had immediately had gone to his home, so that they passed a second time in the blinding storm without knowing it.
Also in Southington, Miss Clara Dunham, at the age of 88, recalled the great storm. Miss Dunham retired to her home in Southington after a career as a home visitor or combined truant officer and welfare worker in the public school system of Philadelphia.
At that time, I was 9 years old. I lived in a house built by my great-grandfather, Cornelius Dunham, in 1788. This was situated on the corner of Queen Street, now Route 10, and what is now called River Street, 3 miles north of the center of Southington. The main house had 2.5 stories, but the L at the back of the house had 1.5 stories. At the time of the blizzard, the snow drifted so that it reached the roof over the back porch on the L. As the well that furnished our drinking water was about 100 feet from the porch, my father and the hired man dug a tunnel, perhaps 16 feet long, through this drift so as to get to the well. The woodshed and wagon shed, the horse barn and pig pen, the chicken house and cow barn and sheep pen were all connected, so no one got lost in the storm when trying to reach the livestock. By the time I went out to the barnyard, a path had been made close to the side of the cow barn with drifts about 10 feet high beside it. In our family, there were my grandmother, my father and mother, my sister, 10 years older than I, and the hired man. I did not go to school that day when the blizzard began, or for several days afterward, although the one-room schoolhouse was fairly near. Ours was a farm of 350 acres, and there was always plenty of wood cut and ready for the wood stoves in the kitchen and living room. Also enough for the one in the parlor when there was special company. There was never any heat in the bedrooms upstairs, just a good feather bed with plenty of warm quilts or comfortables. And on the coldest nights, a flat iron warmed on the kitchen stove and wrapped in a cloth to keep one's feet warm. These were all needed, especially during the blizzard. Candles, which my mother made in candle molds, lighted us to our upstairs bedrooms. We had kerosene lamps to light the table and to read by. The problem of food was difficult for many during the blizzard, but not on the farm. There we had plenty of milk and eggs, hams and sausage and mincemeat. In the cellar were bins of potatoes and turnips and barrels of apples, a tub of lard and one of salt pork, and a stone jar of yeast. There were also canned fruits, preserves, and jellies and pickles. There was on hand rye flour and cornmeal ground from that raised in the fields, and wheat flour bought in smaller quantities. As my father kept 10 or 12 cows and made butter, there was plenty of butter and buttermilk. A few days after the blizzard, two men, teachers, came up from Southington Center as far as our house, trying out snowshoes. The snow had blown away from the south door of the main part of the house, so they could come in, and they asked for a drink of buttermilk. I remember my mother found a quarter in the bottom of the pitcher afterward. I recall that I did some sewing during the storm. I hemmed a linen handkerchief with stitches so small, I never did any like it before or since.
And at Hebron, Connecticut, Miss Susan Pendleton, at the age of 96, talks about the storm in the living room of the house where she was born and where she saw the storm in 1888. Miss Pendleton has written the Hebron News for the Manchester Daily newspaper for many years.
This correspondent for the Manchester Herald can vividly remember the blizzard of 1888 when I was about 17 years old. It was a rara and a terror. The wind shrieking and howling, I don't know how many knots an hour, and the snow whirling and piling up in drifts so deep it looked as if our heads would hardly be able to stick up out of the tops. When a lull came, the first thing the young people did was to start out on an errand of mercy with make-believe snowshoes made with bear staves tied to our shoes and with leggings to keep the snow off. Carrying provisions to the old or sick people and children, milk, bread, and so on. There were no snow plows, telephones, or autos, no bicycles, but plenty of bicycles. But, oh joy, we didn't have to go to school. What was to come next? Down on the Gilead Road, along came a long train of oxen got together from farmers here and there. Down they came, slowly, solemnly, making their big task unconcerned, tossing the drifts off as if there were so many cobwebs. And finally, the main roads were made barely passable. The next thing was a stout hay wagon fixed up, a sturdy old dubbin at the helm, and a man to drive. As many young people as could squeeze in filled the wagon. Oh, the sights we saw, the drifts which had been cut through loomed way up over our heads by the roadsides. We laughed and chatted. It was a great old time. A wedding had been set for the day of the blizzard, and it went through. Miss Jenny Leland of Hebron and Mr. Clifford Robinson of Columbia were married in the Congregational Church. The Reverend J. Lee Dodd officiating, the best man, Wilton Potter, had walked 10 miles from his Sampson, where he was employed to do his part in the ceremony in a new suit of clothes. News of the wedding went all over all parts of the United States in the Police Gazette. The Gazette had it that the wedding couple went to their future home in an ox cart, and they probably did. But it wasn't all comedy, jokes, and fun. A small child of Mr. and Mrs. Edward Gilbert of New York, who were at their country home here, died the day of the blizzard. There was no way to get help, and the father constructed a small casket, placed the child in it, covered from the falling snow, and deposited it in a snowbank until funeral rites could be held. But the story ended in a happier vein. A great drift which had piled up against the front door of the Willie Chamberlain house, as it melted, pressed against the doorbell, causing it to ring, as if to say, "Bye-bye, ta-ta, see you again someday."
Out in Kensington, we visit Miss Pauline Bauer, who lives now in the lovely country home where she was a girl in that memorable day. Here's her story.
On the evening of March 10, 1888, in the Congregational Church in Kensington, Connecticut, a missionary from the far west was addressing an audience. As we came out of the church, snowflakes were falling. It was not unusual for snow to fall at that time of year, so we thought nothing of it. Monday morning, March 11th, it was snowing hard. My father was leaving for New York, and my sister and I were bound for school in New Britain. Our faithful old Swedish man, Nelson, who performed the out-of-door work, had harnessed the powerful gray horse Prince to the two-seated sleigh and driven us to the Berlin Railroad Station. As we drew up to the platform, our minister, Reverend A.J. Benedict, with the missionary, also reached the platform. As we exchanged greetings, the missionary remarked, "If this snow is in the west, we would call it a blizzard." After a long delay, the southbound train pulled into the station. The missionary and my father boarded it, only to be stranded 1 mile north of the New Haven station. My sister and I, with other students waiting for the train to New Britain, were in high good humor, knowing we would be late for school. At last, the New Britain train came in, and we filed aboard. After a long, long time and frequent stops to shovel snow from before the engine, we reached the New Britain station, and there we spent the day, no longer in high spirits, but gravely concerned about the outcome of the adventure. Toward night, a young minister, seeking someone who might need help, came into the station. Why he selected my sister and me, I do not know, but tying handkerchiefs over our mouths, we set out for the Episcopal Rectory. How we made the terrible trip, I do not know. When we reached the house, we were too weak to climb the steps, but dragged by willing hands, we reached safety. Our kind friends kept us until Friday of that never-to-be-forgotten week, when we finally reached home. To go back to Monday, Nelson always met us at the station at 4 o'clock to bring us home. As the time approached, he said to my mother, "I no go, I no go." She exclaimed, "You must go. The girls will start to walk home and fall in the snow." He said no more, but plowing to the barn, he brought Prince out into the yard, where he floundered in snow to his back. My mother saw at once that to go was impossible. At the time, we had a young woman helping with the housework, who with her mother and child lived about an eighth of a mile from us. At 3 o'clock, she started to go home and was a few feet from the porch steps when she fell in a drift. My mother went as far as she could and held out a broom, which fortunately Mary was able to grasp, and was pulled to safety. Not until Thursday did a train from north to south reach the Berlin station. On Thursday also, a boy who attended high school with us fought his way through the drifts across the fields which separated our homes and told my mother where we were.
The people who lived through the storm enjoyed talking about it in later years. It was a story to tell their children and their grandchildren. To this day, there has not been another storm anywhere near its equal.